Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something, well, pretty fundamental in global corporate finance. It's how multinational companies price financial transactions between their own entities. We're talking intercompany loans, debt guarantees, the kind of internal plumbing that keeps big organizations running smoothly. But get the pricing wrong, and you could be facing some serious transfer pricing heat, tax scrutiny. It gets complicated fast. Okay, let's unpack this. Our mission today is really to cut through some of that complexity and focus squarely on the, let's say, the fundamental basis for pricing these financial deals. We want to give you the foundational basics, looking at the approaches, the pros and cons, and maybe most importantly, the big practical pitfalls companies need to watch out for.
Absolutely. It's really essential to get this right. You know, for tax authorities, these kinds of intercompany financial rates, they're often seen as, well, low-hanging fruit for challenges.
Yeah.
Determining the correct arm's-length interest rate or, you know, the proper guarantee fee. It's just not about finding a convenient internal number anymore. You really have to move beyond that kind of convenience towards externally defensible risk-based methods. Because, look, if the transaction isn't backed up by rigorous documentation, the tax office often just sees it as an unsupported transfer of value, basically a gift in disguise.
Right, a gift you might end up paying tax on. So let's start with the basics, definitions. What exactly are the main financial transactions we're focusing on here inside the group?
Yeah, good starting point. We're primarily looking at two mechanisms today. First, there's the straightforward loan. You know, parent company or maybe a central finance entity advances actual funds to a subsidiary. And in return, the subsidiary pays an agreed interest rate. Could be fixed, could be floating. Simple enough on the surface.
Okay, a direct loan. What's the second type?
The second is the debt guarantee. This one's more about risk transfer. Here, the parent acts as a guarantor. It promises a third-party lender, like a bank, that it'll cover the subsidiary's debt if the subsidiary defaults. And crucially for taking on that risk, the borrower, the subsidiary, pays the parent a guarantee fee.
Got it. Loan provides cash, guarantee provides, well, credit enhancement. Now, I know a lot of companies perhaps historically use simpler methods for setting interest rates on those direct loans. Things like just using the parent's own low borrowing cost, or maybe just quickly asking their bank for a quote. Why are those seemingly easy approaches now considered, well, pretty high risk, especially with rule changes a couple of years back?
That's exactly the point. That's the heart of the regulatory shift we've seen. While those methods, like using the parent's funding cost, were common, maybe convenient, they're often just inadequate now. Rules, like the ones updated in Japan back in June 2022, for example, they mandate a really crucial change in focus.
Mm-hmm.
You generally can't set the intercompany interest rate based only on the parent's funding cost anymore, even if that parent has a stellar credit rating.
Why not? If the parent can borrow cheaply, why can't it pass that on?
Well, think about it from an arm's length perspective. A real bank, an independent lender, they don't price a loan based on how cheaply they got their funds. They price it based on the risk profile of the person they're lending to, the borrower.
Oh, okay.
So the rate must primarily reflect the borrower's credit capacity. That's the key. The era of just using internal convenience rates is definitely winding down. It's about objective risk now.
That distinction feels absolutely critical. If the price has to reflect the borrower's risk, then, well, logically, we first need to figure out what that risk is. So assessing the subsidiary's creditworthiness, that sounds like the essential first step before any formulas. Here's where it gets really interesting. How do big companies reliably, you know, defensibly assess their own subsidiaries' credit risk?
Exactly. This step, the credit rating assessment, Kakazuke Hyoka in Japanese, this is really the foundation of your entire transfer pricing defense for these transactions. We generally see three main ways companies go about establishing this rating. First, maybe the most direct but potentially costly method, get an actual third-party rating from an agency, Moody's, S&P, maybe R&I or JCR in Japan.
Okay, an official external rating.
Second, companies can use sophisticated internal rating tools. Things like S&P Capital IQ Risk Calc are quite common. These tools take the subsidiary's financials, the BS and P&L data, and they use quantitative models, sometimes with qualitative overlays, to generate a kind of proxy credit rating.
Right, but those first two, they might struggle sometimes with the group context, wouldn't they? Like, a small subsidiary might look weak on its own financials, but if it's strategically vital, the parent would never let it default. That's where the third method comes in, I assume, the S&P group rating methodology. It explicitly considers that strategic importance, doesn't it?
Precisely. That's the real value of that methodology in this context. It provides a sort of sanctioned, objective way to factor in that implicit group support. It involves looking at the subsidiary's connection to the parent group using, I think it's 8 specific criteria. Things like operational integration, brand linkage, shared management, that kind of stuff.
And based on those criteria, the subsidiary gets classified.
Yes, it leads to one of 5 key classifications that determine the level of expected group support you have. Core, then highly strategic, strategically important, moderately important, and finally non-strategic.
Okay, can you give us a feel for what those mean for the subsidiary's actual credit rating? How does the classification translate?
Sure. The resulting rating for the subsidiary is then determined relative to 2 key benchmarks, the parent's overall group credit profile, or GCP, and the subsidiary's own standalone credit profile, the SACP. The key insight is the potential uplift. So, for instance, if a subsidiary is classified as highly strategic, its final rating might end up being equal to the parent's strong GCP, or maybe just one notch below it. Even if its own standalone financials, the SACP would suggest a much weaker rating.
Ah, so the strategic importance allows it to borrow effectively at a rate closer to the parent's rate because the group wouldn't let it fail.
Exactly. The methodology recognizes that implicit support is real and quantifiable based on that strategic assessment.
And conversely, I suppose, if a sub is deemed non-strategic,
then the parent's rating provides basically no benefit. That entity's borrowing capacity and the interest rate it has to pay will be determined purely by its own potentially weak standalone credit profile, its SACP.
Which means it would have to pay a much higher interest rate on an intercompany loan, reflecting its higher standalone risk.
Correct. It's this objective, documented classification process that gives your eventual pricing its defensibility. You've established the risk profile first, using a recognized framework. Now, and really only now, can you properly start talking about turning that risk rating into a specific price.
Excellent. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, let's talk numbers then. We've got the borrower's rating, reflecting its standalone risk plus any group support uplift. How do we convert that into a concrete interest rate for an intercompany loan?
Well, the standard arm's length formula is actually quite straightforward conceptually. It's a loan interest rate, risk-free rate plus spread or risk premium.
Okay, risk-free rate plus spread, the risk-free rate part. That's just covering the time value of money in baseline conditions, right? Which benchmarks are typically used there?
That depends entirely on the currency and the term of the loan. You calculate the risk-free rate using the appropriate benchmark, maybe TONAF for yen, SOFR for US dollars, Euribor for euro, etc. And it has to reflect the specific date the loan was actually issued. It needs to be current.
Okay, that part seems fairly mechanical. What about the spread? That's the key component reflecting the risk we just assessed, right?
Exactly. The spread is the risk premium. It's added specifically to cover the default risk associated with the borrower's credit rating, the one we just determined. And critically, you need to source this spread from reliable external market data. You can't just, you know, make it up.
Mm-hmm.
Companies typically use databases like Bloomberg or Refinitiv to find the market spreads being charged at that time for bonds or loans issued by entities with that specific credit rating.
So you're finding comparable market transactions.
Precisely. The source material actually gives an illustrative example. Combining the risk-free rate plus a spread derived from, say, the upper limit yields in a database for that rating category might result in a final calculated loan rate of, say, 5.9%.
Yeah.
The point is that 5.9% isn't arbitrary. It's specific. It's based on market data linked to the assessed risk, and therefore it's defensible.
Very clear for loans. Risk-free rate plus a market-derived spread based on the borrower's rating.
Okay, let's switch gears slightly to the debt guarantee fee, the Sijmer-Hoshō-Ryō. This feels conceptually different. It's not about providing cash, but about the parent taking on risk. How do we price that?
You're right, it is different. For guarantee fees, there are generally 2 main approaches accepted by tax authorities to ensure the fee is arm's length. The first, and probably the most commonly used one, is the yield approach. That's approach number 1, approach Ichi.
The yield approach? Okay, what's the logic there?
The basic idea behind the yield approach is that the fee the subsidiary pays should equal the economic benefit it receives from having the parent's guarantee. So the calculation is essentially pre-guarantee interest rate minus the post-guarantee interest rate.
Ah, okay. So let's say a bank would charge the subsidiary 7% interest if it borrowed on its own, standalone. But because the parent provides a guarantee, the bank agrees to lend at maybe 5.5%. The difference is 1.5%. Is that the fee? That 1.5% represents the maximum potential benefit, the interest saving. The actual arm's length fee is the market price for achieving that saving or risk reduction. The source example actually calculates a fee of 1%. This 1% is derived from the difference between what the borrower would have paid without the guarantee, its maximum ceiling rate, and the lower rate it actually pays the bank with the guarantee in place.
Got it. So the fee essentially captures or monetizes that credit uplift provided by the parent's guarantee. Makes sense. What's the second method?
The second one is called the cost approach, approach number two, approach unite. This one focuses less on the borrower's benefit and more on the cost or risk incurred by the guarantor, the parent. The formula is roughly expected loss plus return.
Expected loss plus return. How do you calculate that?
Well, the expected loss component tries to model the probability of the subsidiary defaulting multiplied by the amount the parent would likely lose if that happened. The return component is compensation for the guarantor committing its capital or balance sheet to cover that potential loss.
That sounds potentially more theoretical or harder to benchmark.
It can be, yes. In practice, the yield approach is often seen as, let's say, easier to document and defend, mainly because the borrower's benefit, the interest rate spread, is often more directly observable or quantifiable in the market.
Okay, that helps clarify the two main ways to price guarantees. Now, this brings us to, I think, a really crucial part for listeners.
Yeah.
The practical side, the so what. We can understand the theories, the formulas, but where do things go wrong in practice? What are the common compliance pitfalls, the Jitsumujo no Tuiten, that companies need to be aware of?
Ah, yes, the operational traps. It's vital because, as you said, the best theory falls apart with sloppy execution or documentation. There are probably five key pitfalls we should definitely highlight for ensuring reliability and, crucially, defensibility. First, let's circle back to those bank quotes we mentioned earlier. Bank quotes, you know, the informal estimates you might get from a relationship bank. They cannot generally be used as your primary evidence for transfer pricing.
Really? Even if they seem like market rates, why not?
Because they lack real evidentiary weight. A quote isn't a done deal. It's not an actual consummated transaction where the bank has put its money on the line at that specific rate. Tax authorities want proof based on actual binding market transactions or robust benchmark data to justify your pricing as being truly arm's length. A simple quote usually doesn't meet that standard.
Okay, so indicative quotes are out as primary proof. What's next?
Second, and we've hit this, but it's worth repeating, relying solely on the parent's funding cost, particularly after those rule changes, like the June 2022 update in Japan, this is just insufficient. You must shift the analysis firmly onto the borrower's risk profile and credit capacity. That's non-negotiable now.
Got it. Borrower's risk, not parent's cost. What about features within the loan agreement itself?
Yes. Pay very close attention to the early repayment option. This could be a sneaky trap. Let's say market interest rates fall significantly after the loan is issued.
Right.
The contract allows the subsidiary borrower to prepay or refinance at a lower rate. But the subsidiary chooses not to exercise that option. It just keeps paying the original higher interest rate to the parent.
Why would they do that?
Exactly. From a tax perspective, that inaction looks commercially irrational. Why wouldn't an independent borrower refinance to save money? The tax authority might view that excess interest being paid the difference between the old high rate and the current lower market rate as a non-commercial transfer.
Like a disguised dividend or a gift back to the parent.
Precisely. It could be treated as a deemed dividend or some other form of taxable transfer because the borrower isn't acting in its own economic self-interest, which an arm's length party would.
Wow. Okay. So companies need ongoing monitoring even after the loan is set up, especially if there are repayment options. What else?
Timing is absolutely critical. We talked about using benchmark databases for spreads. The data you use for pricing must be rigorously updated and time-stamped to reflect the actual issue date of the transaction. You need an issue date adjustment. If you priced a loan today based on market data from, say, 3 months ago, and interest rates or credit spreads have moved significantly in the meantime, your entire pricing could be challenged as stale and not reflecting arm's length conditions at the time the deal was done.
So the analysis needs to be contemporaneous with the transaction itself.
Yes, absolutely. And finally, watch out for rollover short-term loans. Sometimes companies issue, say, a three-month loan, but there's an implicit understanding, maybe even a pattern, that it will just keep getting rolled over and over, maybe for years, without the principal ever really being repaid. Tax authorities look at the substance over the form. If it walks like a long-term loan and talks like a long-term loan,
they'll treat it as a long-term loan.
Exactly. They might reclassify it, denying the use of potentially more favorable short-term interest rates or pricing methodologies, and insist you reprice it using long-term benchmarks and spreads, which could be significantly different.
That's a fantastic rundown of the practical hazards. It sounds like the core message is that documentation isn't just about writing down the formula you used. It's about demonstrating through your process and actions that the group companies behaved exactly as independent parties would have, considering all the economic realities at every single stage.
That sums it up perfectly. Pricing these internal financial transactions. It's a really complex blend of rigorous risk assessment, applying the right formulas, and then meticulous execution and documentation. The essential takeaway has to be the absolute necessity of establishing that clear, defensible pricing based first on an objective credit risk assessment, perhaps using something like the S&P group methodology before you even get to calculating the specific interest rate or guarantee fee.
So what does this all mean for you, our listeners? It really signals a fundamental shift. We're moving away from convenience pricing, like just using the parent's cost, or grabbing a quick quote towards verifiable, robust, risk-based methodologies. The foundation has to be that objective assessment of the borrower's actual capacity and risk profile, factoring in group support where appropriate and justifiable. And maybe here's a final thought for you to mull over as we wrap up this deep dive. Think back to the guarantee fee, priced using the yield approach, the benefit the borrower receives. Consider this scenario. What if the calculated arm's length guarantee fee is actually higher than the interest saving the subsidiary gets from the bank because of the guarantee? Why would an independent subsidiary ever agree to pay that fee? It would be cheaper to just borrow without the guarantee. If the pricing doesn't make commercial sense, if it doesn't provide a genuine economic benefit or incentive that aligns with arm's length behavior, does the guarantee truly serve a commercial purpose? Or does it risk looking like just an artificial arrangement to shift profits? Always try to connect the math back to the underlying commercial reality. Does this transaction make sense for both independent parties? Something to think about. Thanks for diving in with us today.